Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, and today I'm joining from the Lombardy region in Italy. June is Indigenous History Month in Canada, so it's an extra important time to be thinking about the intention-action gap when it comes to reconciliation. And today I'm going to double back to a previous recommendation. We always like to think about ways we can bridge the intention-action gap for reconciliation, and today's recommendation is supporting Indigenous businesses. If you have one you like, feel free to pop it in the chat to share with folks. Two of my favorites are Sister Sage Soap and Massey Books. So if you're buying a new Behavioral Insights book, check out Massey Books.
I do love Massey Books.
Moving on, wherever you are and whatever time it is there, we are very happy to have you with us. We have Amara Martinez joining us from New Delhi, so even later for her than it is for me. Amara is a senior program officer with UNESCO's Mahatma Gandhi Institute of Education for Peace and Sustainable Development, where she leads the team on projects related to education, mental health, and youth development, as well as the design, implementation, and evaluation of programs globally. Many of us became familiar with Amara during her previous role as the Director of Policy Research and Analysis at the Western Cape Government in South Africa, where she led the Behavioral Insights portfolio, working on a number of internationally renowned projects, including some of what we'll get to hear about today. Before then and since then, Amara has a long history working in policy and intergovernmental relations, so I think this will be really interesting for our audience. And who better, really, to share lessons about applying BI to large organizations? We're so appreciative of Amara sharing her Friday night with us, so please join me in giving her a warm digital welcome.
Yay.
And I'll stop my screen share and turn it over to you, Amara.
Thanks so much, Kirsten, and hi to everyone on the call. As Kirsten said, I'm joining from Delhi, so really pleased to be here with you, and I'm so glad to see all of you in our virtual. So as Kirsten said, I'll be sharing with you some of the work that I was doing within the Western Cape government in South Africa. And it really is about, sharing that from a perspective, particularly looking at the Global South and sort of what that actually means. So I wanted to almost start off with sort of giving you a little bit of a flavor of where we are at, and kind of most of you may have seen this particular map or may not have seen it, but it is a map that was developed by our colleagues at the OECD. And it really was put together to really sort of map out the most of the behavioral science projects are being run, both within inside of government as well as outside of government. And so you can't really see all of the names, but the point of this is just to say that most of the work within the Global South or in the world today, rather, is mostly sort of cornered to the West. And so one looks at this map and all of it is basically on top. Very few is happening in the South. And so most of the work that we've been doing right at the edge of Africa, literally the end of the world, is predominantly focused on how we apply behavioral science to public policy. And so when this was drafted by our friends at the OECD, there were about 200 organizations applying behavioral insights to public policy. At the moment, of course, it's grown so much, and we're probably sitting at around 400 institutions, both within and outside of government, applying BI to public policy. So in terms of sort of how we sort of looked at behavioral science and the work that we've been doing, the brand sort of at the Western Cape government has been the BI for Gov brand. And so this was sort of a process, and also really looking at how we looked at the work over a number of years. So the Western Cape government, my previous organization, was one of the first institutions to actually adopt and implement behavioral insights to public policy. We started this process as early as 2012. And so for those of you that know some of the history of behavioral insights, the UK Cabinet Office was actually one of the first public institutions to implement behavioral science into public policy. We then, as the regional government, sort of worked with them, and our behavioral insights team was born in 2012. At this time, it was a partnership with Ideas 42, which some of you may know, based in the US, as well as a local university in University of Cape Town. And in 2018, we started our first brand, which really was about not looking as sort of broad as what we did when we just started in 2012, but really seeing how we could align what we do to our strategic priorities within the province and the country at that time. And through this, BI Program was born in 2018. So since the departure of myself from government last year, the BI for Gov brand has sort of been taken with me and has evolved into a community network, particularly for those in the Global South, but also more broadly about how we could work together better with our partners in the Global North. So here it's really been our goal is to improve and increase the government's capacity across the globe to use the principles of behavioral science to tackle not only the easy problems. And I think, you know, when I say easy problems, you know, when you're looking at sort of, you know, changing things in an aisle in the supermarket, you know, like sort of putting the healthier foods to the front and the not so healthier foods at the back of the shop. And so really looking at sort of these intractable social problems, so these wicked social challenges. And I think I'll get into more of that just a bit later. So since 2020, we were working on a couple of areas, quite a few areas in fact. So we looked at how to use behavioral science to reduce violence, and particularly interpersonal violence. We also looked at climate change and thinking about environmental sustainability, then also on sort of healthy and active living. So here it's really about individual well-being as well as sort of community health and well-being. The fourth area, which is probably where we did the most of our work, because this is where our need was the greatest. And so here was predominantly in the education space. And then, of course, because of the high HIV and infection rates in the country, we had a big focus on HIV awareness as well as health. So what I wanted to share with you today was really about a project which we did in the education sector. And it was really about how we wanted to cultivate a growth mindset in our learners. It was predominantly in the school space, and I wanted to share with you some of the things that we've learned, how we moved to this particular pilot to scale, and also some of the challenges that we had along the way, which were many. So we really focused on sort of looking at why we needed to do this type of project within our space. And so for us, it was really thinking about, you know, we needed to think about our particular profile and what we needed to do to actually turn things around. And so I talked about these sort of wicked challenges, and this was certainly one of them. So this sort of graphic really gives you an understanding of some of the indicators of that measures multidimensional poverty. So what we said is that there was a couple of indicators in the health space, in the education space, that we needed to look at. Because when you look at the profile of South Africa, and I think it rings true for any developing country, is that poor people are not only poor, but they also, for example, don't have access to information and connectivity. They are poor and don't have access to sort of basic quality basic services. They also have access to low quality schooling, which of course makes them sort of doubly poor. So it's thinking about that in that lens. And so what we found in our own province was that almost a quarter of young people that was living in the province. And so if we think about the numbers, we have about 7 million people living in that particular region. And a quarter of them were seen as multidimensional. So that number is quite staggering if you think about both the need, but also just what the situation and the profile was there. So what we thought about was sort of looking at a understanding of growth mindset and what that actually meant. So for us, it was really thinking through, you know, if we think about growth mindset, we wanted them to understand that irrespective of the circumstances and the lack of opportunities that they may have, it doesn't mean that they can't change their own sort of trajectory and the way that they think about themselves and the way that they actually approach problems. So we want to really move it. For those of you that may not know what a growth mindset is, it's really about a belief about one's own abilities, and it lands on a continuum. So moving from a fixed mindset, which is really thinking that, you know, because I don't know a maths problem and I'm studying with it, that I'll never be able to actually know this. So really believing that if you are born with certain abilities, you cannot change them. To moving towards actually believing that, you know, with practice and with perseverance, you are able to cultivate a particular skill through effort and hard work. And so it was really us thinking that, you know, particularly in low SES communities, you are able to actually change this, you know, thinking about themselves and also how that actually applies to their academic outcomes. So really our theory of change was to think about growth mindset in a way that you actually shift this inequality dial. And I think it's important to kind of see it in that way, because what we really thought about was that if you improve social and emotional skills, you will be able to sort of improve learner academic outcomes. So our theory of change was really that by teaching a growth mindset, you'd be able to improve learner attitudes towards learning, irrespective of where they came from, which would sort of lead to increased effort and perseverance, which would eventually lead to improved academic outcomes. So I suppose you're wondering how this all came about. So basically we partnered with the World Bank, and they were doing studies elsewhere. So we were not the first country to do this type of intervention, but it was being tested with success in a few countries like Macedonia, Peru, and Indonesia. And what they saw in Peru was that their study looked at about 50,000 students aged between 11 and 14 years old. And it was a 90-minute session where students and teachers really discussed an article on how your brain can grow. The results were really measured by comparing standardized tests in maths and Spanish literacy. And some of the outcomes that they saw was that they saw a 0.2 standard deviation increase in the test scores. And so what that means practically is that it's the equivalent of having 2 or 3 more years of schooling for your parent. And so what we know also from the literature is that if your parents have more education, you are more likely to succeed, both in the education system and then later on in life. I think when I first had a conversation with the bank, one of the things I asked them was how cost effective is this? Because of course, if you are in a big organization, particularly in the government sphere, you want to know how much things cost. You don't have an infinite amount of resources, and so it's really thinking about what this might mean. The intervention was very cheap, you know, and it was cost effective. And we then sort of started with looking at how we can really do this, you know, for our own kids. So really when thinking about the intervention itself, it was sort of, it followed a few phases. And so again, one of the very important partners that came on board at that time was the World Bank, UC Davis University in California, who were sort of our partner and strongest partner in terms of actually looking through the instruments and making sure that everything was sort of rigorous. And we did a baseline assessment, which was really a maths assessment, a survey and a puzzle. And this really ran for 60 minutes over one day. The intervention itself was a range of 5 3-minute videos, and I'll show you one of those videos in just a moment, which was really spread over 3 days, and that was our treatment. And so it was really an animated video which used a fictional character, sort of an avatar. His name is Mojo, and you'll meet him in just a moment. And we also had a control group, which was really animal videos, National Geographic videos at that point. We then had a reinforcement, which was really where we rewatched all of those videos for the kids. And these are kids in high school and primary school. And they also needed to do some drawing and data writing exercise to really make them, we wanted to ask them, you know, what did they understand from the content? What did they understand in terms of what Mojo was saying? And this was really 45 minutes over one day. We then subsequently had another reinforcement, because we really realized that it was important for us to, you know, think about it in terms of, if you are providing an intervention to any sort of school-going age child, the chances are that if you're sort of doing it in September as we did, and then doing another intervention in March, they probably would have forgotten what they learned. So it was really important for us to do another follow-up to really make that stick. And then in the end, and that was sort of mid-April, we did an end line, which consisted again of our math assessment survey and puzzle. So I just wanted to share with you a video, and this was one of the videos, I think it's number one in the sort of group, and it was really just to show you what they were actually looking at and what the intervention and mojo is. So please enjoy.
Chapter 1. Mojo discovers a secret about his brain. A secret that will change the way he looks at the world forever. Our story begins with Mojo, a friendly monster who loved school, especially math. Until one day, when something terrible happened. The math problems got harder. Nothing made sense anymore. Mojo had a devastating thought. He just wasn't smart enough for school. It seemed the only reasonable thing to do was pack his things and leave forever. Just then, he heard his friend Katie laughing. "Mojo, you can't just give up," she said. "I have no choice, Katie," said Mojo. "You're either born smart or you're not. And I realize today that I'm not." "Mojo, that's not how it works," said Katie. "Anyone can be smart. You just have to work at it." "That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard," said Mojo. "It's not ridiculous, it's science," said Katie. "Neuroscientists studied the brain for years and discovered an incredible secret, that your brain is like a muscle. When you try challenging things, like those hard math problems, you're giving your brain the exercise it needs to get stronger, which makes you smarter." "Is that really true?" said Mojo. "Of course," said Katie. "It's like how when you were a baby, you didn't know how to talk. But you kept trying, exercising your brain, until one day you could."
"Mojo!"
Mojo couldn't believe what he was hearing. If your brain was really like a muscle, did that mean anyone could become smarter? Even him? He turned to ask Katie, but just then, she had to be off to her next class. But maybe you can answer Mojo's question. What do you think? Can Mojo become smarter? What about you? Now that's an interesting question indeed.
So that really gives you a little bit of a flavor of sort of what we were sort of playing to the kids. And they, and as I said, this was sort of one of the five videos that we showed to them. And I think it was important for us not to have sort of any races or any sort of shapes on there, but rather look at it from an avatar perspective. One of the things that, you know, I just want to say, just before we come to the high school academic outcomes, what we saw was that there were very different results for our high school children as well as our primary school children. And I'll go a little bit into that in just a moment. So what we saw in the high school was that through a math test, we saw a 10% increase in their maths marks, or the math results. And it was really very much similar to what we saw in the other sort of growth mindset projects in the other countries like Peru and Macedonia and Indonesia. And it was really comparable to this 2 to 4 months of catch-up in maths. And I think, you know, when we think about this particular outcome, it's important just to state that this impact only holds for learners who actually attended all three sessions. And so here it's important just to emphasize that dosage is quite important. You know, it's no use that the child comes once or twice, but they needed to at least come three or more sessions in order for the intervention to actually be effective. In the primary school, a little bit different, although we got some positive results, it was not statistically significant. And I think for us, this was very important to understand why this was. And some of the explanations or more hypotheses was that we were unable to really measure this dosage. And this was really about just an implementation challenge that we had. So the attendance registers were being manned by some of the sort of peer learners in the classroom, and it was being manually done because they didn't have access to computers. And so here the human error came into account, where we couldn't actually know whether a child was attending two times or three times or four times because it wasn't being recorded. The second thing, and I think probably the most important thing for us, particularly as we look at the scale-up, is the language barriers. So in South Africa, what we see is that the first few years of a child's life, they are taught in their mother tongue. And so this is actually not English. And so these videos were, of course, in English, and some of them were not able to understand for this reason. The third thing is really about looking at how young people understand and the ability for them to understand this idea about the growth mindset and building perseverance, building resilience. And so we thought it might just be difficult to actually adjust young children's attitudes and behaviors, particularly those in the primary school. And I think for all of these things, even though we didn't see sort of statistically significant results, we still went ahead with a scaled up version. But what was important to us to really make sure of was that we actually dub the videos into our local languages. And I think this really helped us to move forward. So I want to also share now a little bit of the lessons learned, because I think that even though we were lucky enough to get a positive result, we also learned a lot along the way. And this really helped us not only for this project, but also sort of moving forward in terms of what this looked like for other sort of pilots and projects later on. So, you know, for us, and particularly for me, you know, heading up the program, a lot of the roles that I needed to take was, you know, multifold. And I think some of the stuff that I would do is to actually interpret, you know, so when you're saying statistically significant, what does this mean to a decision maker who perhaps doesn't have a statistic background or doesn't really care about that? You know, they want to know, does this thing work or not? And if it does work, why does it work? And if it doesn't work, why doesn't it work? And so it was really this idea about, you know, being a sense maker, being able to translate the data into something that's tangible. The other thing I think which is quite important, you know, particularly in large organizations, is to actually advocate for your work. And I think this is critically important in terms of, you know, how you sell your product, how you sell behavioral science. Why is this important? You know, what do I need to do to convince people? Because I think a lot of people may not be convinced of the value of behavioral science, particularly if they have never been exposed to the discipline, and even to the methodology, which may seem a bit strange to some, because immediately one thinks about solutions, you know, but you're not thinking about, am I actually defining and diagnosing that particular problem correctly? Also, really, you know, being an entrepreneur, because you need to think creatively about how to solve problems. You cannot just do it the same way that you've always done, particularly in a very highly bureaucratic system with many layers, with lots of hierarchy. You need to think creatively and differently about issues. And I think also, you know, thinking about, you know, some of the stuff that we saw was really about, you know, how do you start? And so for me, I always sort of make the point that you need to really start small but strong. And so what do I mean by this? I think it's important to, even if there's very little appetite or you may not have enough funding or you may not have the team, it's important to just start with something. And sort of start with those that are willing. So really thinking also about the focused selection of pilot projects and initiatives, especially when you are just starting. I think one of the lessons which we learned along the way that we started with many, many projects, and I showed the first slide, you know, focusing on all different sort of subjects and topics, but what we found was that it was really good at that time to start quite broad. But in the end, so when we came to about 2018, we could see that we needed to really pivot a little bit to think about what was a strategic priority for the government or the organization or wherever you may find yourself. I think another big thing to bear in mind is having a very diverse team. So varied sort of experience, varied disciplines, and really trying to understand also how to run projects. I think there's, you know, enough is not said about project management skills and being able to implement large-scale projects, and I think that this is important. I think another thing that maybe we don't always think about enough is having the data governance systems to be able to do the work that you need to do within big organizations, and also access to data. So data may exist, and there's lots of data, but can you really access it to actually implement your project? And I think one of the sort of the most important things that, you know, we've learned over the years is that, you know, it doesn't mean that something may seem like it's impossible to really apply behavioral science leads to that it will fail. And so this willingness to really take risks and encourage innovation amongst your teams, amongst the people that you're working with, because, you know, it's also about accepting that failure will happen, but how do you learn from that failure to improve as you go along? So, you know, in terms of us making the case for behavioral science in big organizations, I think three big things that came out was the ability to convince the decision makers. So whether that is your CEO, whether that is your director general of a government department, whether it's someone else, I think it's about showing the evidence and really having this proof of concept. I think this is critically important, particularly for those that may be a bit skeptical or not really sure what behavioral science is and the value that it could eventually add to an organization. I think the second thing is about those that you are actually trying to serve, so the beneficiaries, those within your study or your pilot, really making sure that you gain their buy-in, I think, from the beginning. So they're not just seen as somebody in an experiment, but somebody who's actually taking the journey with you as you're implementing. So, you know, include them as far as possible from the start. If you can't do that, at least make sure that you have those feedback. So when they're coming for focus groups or interviews or whatever it may be, giving them feedback as to what happened to the information that I gave you. People need to feel that they are actually included, and this sort of makes things easier if you need to go back to that community in future. I think also thinking a little bit to the future, if you think about a pilot and sort of looking at how you mainstream that, you need to be able to get the implementer, if it's not you, to understand what this means and what the pilot is about, so you don't lose the fidelity of your pilot, and you're also taking them along with you as you go. So I sort of want to end with this slide, which is really about some of the success factors and particularly key takeaways. I think what we've learned across all these years was that you really need to think about how the work that you're doing is actually relevant to the existing priorities. How does this relate to your strategic priorities? How does it relate to your political priorities, particularly if you are in government? And also maybe thinking about framing of the problem. So sometimes decision makers in any sphere, whether they're in government or in the private sector or even in the NGO or development sector, think about a problem really sort of one in one uniform way, really in a linear way. And so it's thinking about, you know, how do you frame the problem in a way that they might see it as an issue that they would be interested in. You know, it's about thinking about the long-term impact. So yes, it may not necessarily show an immediate impact, but maybe particularly in education, the returns on investment over the long term is actually quite good. And then also partnerships. I think none of the work that we've done over the past few years could have been done without partnerships. And I think it's important to, if your government partner with academia, if your government partner with an NGO, partner with the private sector, because often, you know, these unlike minds produce things that are really, really useful, and you are able to really get different perspectives, which really always make the quality and also the substance of the work that you do much more key to what you're trying to address. I think the third thing is about, you know, not just seeing, and I said this earlier about behavioral science only being used for sort of, you know, issues on like, you know, putting healthy food in the front of the supermarket as an example. Yes, that is important, but I think don't only see that as a way that behavioral science can actually be used to address macro or sort of issues. You know, think about it also in, sometimes it can be used to be a vital component to address these macro level sort of wicked social challenges. And I think very, very importantly, from the work that we've done, none of this could have happened if we didn't have a champion. So having that sort of political or administrative person, particularly if you are in other large organizations, not in government, that champions the work that you do. I mean, often people see sort of these things as, you know, I'm saying the same thing all the time because I'm a BI person. But if somebody else sees it, then suddenly, you know, the message gets across. So having the right messenger is also quite important. Then I think the fourth thing is about really building in sufficient time required for your implementation. So yeah, you know, it's very important in terms of sort of looking at those outcomes and making sure that you're building in time for this. I think the fifth thing is about your ability to really, particularly in large organizations, which we might take for granted, is actually how procurement works. How long are things going to take to get activated within in the system? How do your IT processes work? Will this help or hinder the work that you need to do? And perhaps you need to make friends with those in procurement, in HR, in IT, to be able to move the work that you need to do up the ranks to be able to get approved, as an example. And then the sixth thing and last point that I'll share with you is, you know, making sure that when you are looking at your pilot as far as possible, and I know sometimes resources are not always available over the longer term, but if you can, make sure that you plan for scale up from the pilot phase so that you don't sort of land up in a position that at the end of a pilot, a year or two goes by, you don't actually have the resources and the plans to actually scale up. So this also needs to be embedded if you're thinking about scale in the long term, so that you don't just do a pilot, it ends and then nothing happens. So I think that's important, you know, as you go, and to ensure that, of course, there's sustainability over time. So I think I'll leave you with that. Over to you, Chris.
That was amazing. I see the digital applause coming in. It's always a little quieter, but I see it coming through. So many great quotes there. I was actually taking notes about quotes, which you don't usually get in a BI talk, but some really quotable, really great takeaways. And I saw in the chat, a lot of folks are really curious. A few folks were asking if the materials are available online, and I think we found them. There were a couple questions, and I'm just scrolling to see if I can find them, and then we'll go to folks who have hands raised. All right. Chennai asks, the theory of change emphasizing the potential for growth mindset to influence academic outcomes is very interesting. Did any aspect of this project include policy levers to address structural factors or barriers to achievement?
That is a really good question. Thanks for that. Yes, I mean, and I'll also explain to you a bit about why we chose academic outcomes, right? So, of course, one wouldn't necessarily think that that's the first thing that you think about in a project like this. But because we were in a system that, education systems as a whole, traditionally has always been about who scores the highest in class, you know, who's got the best math mark. So it's always this thing about competition and where I rank. And so decision makers particularly are concerned about that, because when they get scored on sort of grades. And so we needed to almost kind of latch the ego's mindset to a tangible outcome. Everybody's interested in how to improve academic outcomes. And so we did this specifically because we wanted to show that actually, if you do these things, and if you install social and emotional skills, which are kind of, you know, for some people seen as soft skills, the hard skills will actually improve. And so that was the reason why we chose sort of academic outcomes in particular. But I think what you're asking about policy levers, and particularly the structural factors, is an important one. Because, of course, with the behavioral intervention, it probably won't change the structural factors. You know, people are still going to be poor. They're still not going to have money for data connectivity. They're still not going to be able to get to school or whatever the case may be. But I think what this did do is that through the project, we had to involve some of the caregivers and the parents, both to get consent, but also to tell them about what we're doing. And we said to them, you know, like, this is important from a societal perspective to allow your child to understand that even though I'm from a gated township and, you know, maybe all my friends around me don't have access to this, or maybe somebody in my family is in jail, it doesn't mean that I need to be there. You know, I can actually overcome these things with a little bit of perseverance and grit and effort, and at least try. You know, of course, it might not always land in a positive outcome, just because we can't expect this mojo intervention to change the whole sort of community societal issues. But certainly it can help with letting young children think about problems differently. And I think if we at least do that, we would have done something. So I think, you know, with behavioral science as a whole, we shouldn't believe that we are able to change things structurally. I think what we should do, and I mean, this is just a very personal view, is that when we are doing a behavioral science intervention, you also need to think about how do I improve the structural elements. So a very sort of basic idea was that kids are coming to the intervention after school, which means that they wouldn't have food. Right? The kids that we were working with was sort of a low sort of income communities and generally don't get food. So we actually had sort of sandwiches and fruit for them to be able to come to the intervention. So this was kind of one of the structural things that we put in place to ensure that, you know, kids that are coming are fit, you know, and then are able to actually do the behavioral change intervention while also giving them the food that they would have never gotten anyway. So I think always building this into your interventions makes a lot of sense, particularly in the Global South.
Thank you. And we have another question in the chat. This one's from Jeremy. Jeremy says, thank you for sharing the caveat regarding how effects only held for students who attended 3+ sessions. It makes sense, but at the same time, sounds like there's a risk of selection effects. Was there any way to deal with that alternative explanation, or is that simply a limitation?
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. So the one thing I didn't tell you about was all of the implementation challenges that we had. So at the point of sort of running the experiment, we had a range of different things happening at the same time. The one thing was where we sort of had public transport violence and strikes. So people were not only striking, but there was also sort of gang violence and sort of what we call taxi violence, which is really just our public transport sort of minivans that transported people from one place to the next. And it just so happened that this happened in the middle of our intervention. And what that meant was that our regional sample size was drastically reduced because kids were not coming because it was too violent. And what this meant was that was certainly a limitation and also influenced sort of how many times kids came. So yes, definitely the selection bias thing comes up, but this is something that, you know, one needs to deal with. And so you will have this perfect research design and implementation plan and all of these things, but in reality, these things don't always work out to plan. And even more so in the Global South, because things happen. You know, sometimes there's gang violence, you have to deal with it. Kids are not going to come. You just have to substitute, you have to make a plan. And so, you know, unfortunately, it's never going to be perfect. But I think it's about what do you do and how do you sort of innovate to be able to get as close to the research design that you would want to have without sort of compromising things. So it's a little bit of a balancing act. Not ideal, of course. But this is the real world. So yeah, I think it's a bit of both. Thanks for that question, Jeremy.
Wonderful. And I see we have a hand from Dave, and then we'll go back to the chat questions.
Hi, Amara. Thanks for the great presentation. Really enjoyed it. And like you interesting. It's especially great to hear about BI work in the Global South. So really appreciate you joining us here today. And it got me thinking actually about using a growth mindset for BI, because doing BI can be a challenge, but it's also something that we all can improve at over time as well. So I appreciate your perspective. And my question is, did you, in addition to grades, did you look at any other indicators? And specifically, I'm wondering about mental health, because I have read that growth mindset can also be helpful for mental health, right? You think about challenges and failure differently, right? And maybe in a healthier way, and it can lead to better mental health. So I was wondering if that's something you looked at or not, and if so, what you found. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. No, we didn't look at mental health. I think we needed to be quite sort of lean in terms of what we were going to measure and what we were going to actually measure against. And particularly, I think the mental health aspects for children would have been difficult in terms of data. Because one could think of it maybe absenteeism, but you wouldn't get a medical result because that's confidential information. So I think working with learners poses certain challenges, particularly with confidentiality, and education systems are very, very opposed to providing learner-level data. And so a lot of the stuff that we got, was quite protected for understandable reasons. So I think, yes, it would be a fantastic indicator. And I think what this study actually helped me to think about is, and I was telling Kirsten about this earlier, was that we doing a study at the moment about how we could think about social and emotional learning for decision makers, and how do we equate that with mental health, or so mental well-being. And so thinking through what that actually means and some of the indicators, and there you could, as an example, use teacher data. So you could think about it in terms of the amount of absenteeism or the reasons for absenteeism. And there it is documented through the data why teachers are actually not in school. And there you could sort of make the links between social and emotional skills versus mental health challenges, and if there's any correlation there.
Thanks.
And so another question that's in the chat, and this one might be both to Amaro, but also just to the general assembled folks. Are there resources for organizations who might be interested in BI projects, particularly in the education sphere and or Global South, but lack the know-how to get started and learn more or apply for BI project grants? So I'll pass that to Amaro, but if folks have other ideas, feel free to populate them in the chat.
No, thanks for that. One of the things, that we've seen, there's a lot of different organizations. So, there's one particular organization that, works on the African continent in particular. Maybe you heard about them, PUSADA. And they've been doing a lot of work in this space, in terms of getting resources. And I'll drop, some of their things in the chat. But I think it's also just figuring out, getting started, I think, is about, linking up with those in the field, and I think particularly for those thinking about work in the Global South, I think it's always important that if you are going to be doing work there, speak to people who are in the field. Sometimes, and I think a lot of the issues that I've faced personally is that we don't document what we do enough, because we're always doing this stuff, and so challenges arise all the time, and I certainly always get enough chance to be able to document what I'm doing. And this is something that's completely like on us as a community to say, we need to document more. We need to say when things are going well, when things are not going well, how do we sort of put that out there? And so it could also be that, people within the community come together and say, yes, we may not have time to document this, but can I help you be able to do that? So looking to academia, looking to other organizations to really get the word out. And I think that this is important. So, I think just also plugging into various conferences that are happening. There's always something happening. Going to now, we've gone back to sort of in-person conferences. It's a great place to connect with people, hear people. And I think the one thing about the BI community globally is that everyone's really nice. And so people are always open to kind of communicate, do things, and collaborate. collaborate. So I think that would kind of be my, and also, you know, reading books, podcasts, I think that, that makes a huge difference just to keep up to date with some of the trends. Yeah.
Fantastic. And maybe I'll ask one of my own questions. I was curious, so most of what you talked about today was about your work with Cape Town, but now you're in this new role in another large organization. And so I'm curious, those lessons you told us, the takeaways, have you been able to apply them in the new role? And has that changed what your takeaways and lessons are? Or what's kind of an update that you're on?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really good question. Because, you know, a year on from my previous role, sort of sitting in now in an international organization and thinking about problems sort of globally, I think the scope for behavioral science is huge. And at the moment, the UN has, the Secretary General has passed a resolution, I think a year or two ago, saying that behavioral science needs to be infused into what the UN does. I think in terms of practice, there are some institutions, and I think there's a behavioral science week that's coming up. Mary and her sort of outfit is doing. So Mary McLennan is doing a lot of work within the BI space in the UN. But I think, you know, as agencies, there's so many UN agencies, and of course, a lot of work is happening. But in terms of that, it's also really new. So I would say it's not embedded. I don't think so. I mean, there's a lot of good work, for example, happening in WHO, a very good, a sort of big health resolution that was passed by all member states, sort of all, I think, 194 member states, basically saying that in order to change behavior in the health sector, we need to use behavioral science, which is huge. So what that means is that sort of countries have now pledged and sort of committed to the fact that they will start thinking about behavioral science in how they actually design their programs, how they implement their programs through a behavioral lens. And I think one of the sort of the good things coming out of COVID is that it really emphasized this idea that we need to change behavior, and the best way to do that is actually through the behavioral sciences. So it really did sort of elevate the work that we've been doing as a community. Out of a crisis, of course, not the most ideal conditions, but it has elevated the use, the value of behavioral science. And this, I think, is something that we should capitalize on. But yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the lessons that I've learned is that, you know, it takes time to build appetite and willingness to apply like behavior change or behavioral science or whatever you want to call it to policy, to global policy, to any system. And that really is something that you need to work on every day and consistently. And so, you know, it does feel that I'm back to convincing in terms of the value. And but, you know, I think it's a challenge because now it's not just about a particular region of a country, but rather all member states. And so I am excited about the prospect that holds.
Thank you. Any other questions? I don't see any in the chat, but I'll give folks a moment. Or if anyone has one, feel free to raise a hand. Or if you can't figure out the raise a hand, you can go ahead and unmute. And presumably all 35 of us will have questions at the same time, and it'll work out okay. So I'll just pause for a second and see if there's other questions. Looks like there's one in the chat, and Dave has his hand again, so I'll read the one in the chat. If it would be possible to share any links for BI research on family violence, I would really appreciate it. I have a friend who does a lot of work in this space here in Canada, and that's a question from Monique. So I don't know if, Amara, if you have anything on that from your work in Cape Town?
Well, yes and no, but so just before I left, we were doing most of my work has sort of been within the school system. And we recently, sort of the last project that I was working on was a cognitive behavioral therapy project with school-going youth, sort of grades 8 and 9, so kind of like 14, 15 years old, where we were trying to really build skills of self-regulation, emotional awareness, empathy, to reduce violence. And so this was really thinking about it in the reduction of violence by almost sort of regulating your own emotions. So as an example, if somebody was in a school environment and somebody sort of slapped you, whatever the case may be, would your initial reaction be to kind of punch them back or slap them back? Or could we use a way where we actually slow down your automatic response rate to violence? So we used a couple of techniques, and we've now launched the program in about 46, 50 schools. You know, I just got some updates from some of my former colleagues, and they have seen some really wonderful results in terms of using CBT for sort of a reduction in violence, which inevitably will have spillover effects to the community. So thinking about that in terms of how to control your anger, how to control your emotions, and even identifying how you're feeling as an individual has really seen some good results. We haven't done a proper sort of impact evaluation as yet because it has been quite recent. So the project sort of ended at the end of 2022. They are going to be looking at an evaluation soon. But I can certainly sort of put you in touch with the guys that we were working with there, and they do a lot of work at the Chicago Crime Lab, where they do a lot of this sort of Becoming a Man program, which is focused on juvenile delinquents, which might be interesting in terms of just getting that, and they would be happy to help with sort of this family violence angle as well. So that is something that I could certainly recommend.
Thank you. And Dave?
Thanks for giving me another chance to ask a question, Amara. It's such great projects. So about your growth mindset study, I was wondering how you randomized, and specifically I'm thinking about, normally we kind of default to randomizing at the level of the individual, but I was wondering if here it might, the intervention might actually be more powerful, you know, if randomized, if it's done at the classroom level. Because then it's also about your peers, right, the teacher, and it might be more powerful if you get everyone in the social group thinking in the same way, right, versus just operating on individuals and where maybe their friend is thinking something else. So I was curious how you did that and how you think about that. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think we randomized actually at the classroom level, in fact. So we did do that. But of course, you know, once you do that, and the people that are not in the intervention, there might be some spillover. So I think that was, you know, some of the risk that we had. But so, you know, half of the class were put into the treatment, and half of the class was put into the control. But I think what we saw there was that we tried to keep it sort of, even if it was one classroom. So we had one classroom, and they would come and they would split them. Specifically. So this was how we did it from a very practical perspective. And we, like, nobody knew which one they were in, obviously. So they could either get animals. They obviously believe that everybody's watching videos, so we're all watching the same thing. But of course, after the study, then they were like, oh, you got animals and I got Mojo. Well, that's interesting. But they didn't understand, you know, so it was kind of just, oh, this was interesting. I didn't do that. But my videos of the starfish was really fun. So it was very interesting to see the actions afterwards. But I think there's always that risk you run of spillover. But I think we needed to keep it quite tight because of both the sort of structural issues that we had within the school, and also because we were doing it in an after-school space. So we needed to be very clear about sort of who we targeted, were they safe, did they have sort of, like, did this class have the safety to be able to walk back after the program, particularly in a high violence sort of suburb. So I think that's the way that we did it. It wasn't always perfect, but as I said to you, you know, it was the best that we could do at that point.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Wonderful.
we are actually at time. We had such a great Q&A. So thank you so much, Amara. And I'm just going to share my screen one last time. If it will work. Okay, there we go. Now I've lost all of you, which is the new Zoom thing I've been hearing everyone complain about. There we go. So thanks so much to Amara for a fascinating presentation. This is amazing. Hopefully you can enjoy the rest of your weekend now that your Friday night, late night is done. And a huge thank you as well to our audience for joining us both today and all year long. This is our last seminar of this academic year, but we will be back next academic year. And here's a sneak peek at our lineup for this coming year. So hopefully we'll see some of you online in the fall. And as you most likely know, we share the recordings on the wiki, so that's a great place to check in, and we'll be back next year. Thank you all so very much.
Thanks, Kristen. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Thanks so much. So that is the behavioral science. I've studied this now. I've been to many behavioral science or UPC DIBS webinars. It's something that is, whenever I get this in my inbox, I always put it in my calendar right away because I learn a lot about the why of things, why people behave this way. And just at the end when they were talking about violence and sort of how we react to being struck, I feel that's really important for me right now. I feel like I am now learning that, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind, and that if I take my initial, I often say every action has an equal and opposite reaction, and that is again like a sort of a scientific quote to take some of the, well, this happened, so this happened, and I got yelled at, so I yelled at someone else, and I see how it has to stop somewhere. It has to stop at the person who's most aware. And just recently at my council meeting in the public input section, I'm being, attacked, and, that's how I feel. I feel like I'm being verbally attacked, and, someone is like, oh, you are just helping yourself, look it up, do this research, and I have, and I am, and I am piggybacking off the Gold River program for the Good Food Box, and so I know I'm in the right, but I can just sit there and shake my head and listen and then move adjournment because I'm not going to take any bait anymore. I'm done. It takes two to tango. And if someone wants to dance with me, then I have every ability to say no. I'm having a new layer of maturity now. And I can say no thank you and I can walk away. And that's okay. I don't need to fight every fight that I'm invited to. And I don't need to educate people who are more convinced that they're right and they don't need to listen to anything anyone else has to say. I just won't say anything. This is where it's come to now. I feel the best thing for me, like I've learned a lot from Mayor Davis over the last 5 years of being his deputy. And, when someone says something to trigger a reaction in him, he has this amazing ability to say, thanks for that, and move on, and not take the bait. And so I am going to continue on this journey of learning how to let cooler heads prevail and stay calm and carry on and be someone who is, maybe saying, oh, are you okay? And, I can see that you're really worked up and upset. And I can't engage in that because I don't want to get worked up and upset because my peace and calm is valuable to me. It helps me make better decisions. It helps me stay open and giving. I guess the last seconds here, I'll share something that I've worked on for my last communications planning class as this episode of the Waterfowl podcast runs down. Sarah Fowler does her best to make the best of what she has. It can be challenging to remain open and giving to the needs of others. Many people in her community don't want anything to change, but everything always is. To be successful in her second term, she thinks the best outcome would be to keep people safe and take steps, however small, towards sustainability, especially around food and transport. Thanks for listening to The Waterfowl. Quacktastic. Bye-bye.